Okay, let me go ahead and introduce everybody. This is, we've got Dr. Eric Carlstrom, who is back again co-hosting with me, and our guest again is Dr. Timothy Ball. And he is back, and as usual, he's going to bring us some great information. And I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And this is KHIN LP 106.9 Salida. And again, I want to state that the programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. We are going some revisions on the site right now, so if you do come up with a password, just click the arrow up at the top of the toolbar and go back and go back in, and it will let you in to view the archives. And hopefully that will be corrected here soon. And so, Dr. Carlstrom, would you like to go ahead and introduce our guest this evening? Did I lose you?
Yes, it'd be a pleasure. Speaking of your archives, Melody, I was on there today, and I noticed that we actually have 8 interviews with Dr. Tim Ball already, so this would be the 9th. And this has been a great series. Dr. Tim Ball is a climatology professor from Canada. He lives in Winnipeg, and he's one of the first PhD students of Hubert Lam from the University of London. Hubert Lam wrote the book on climate and human history. And so Dr. Ball has had a distinguished career both in research and in teaching. And he has been one of the earliest and foremost and most consistent and vigorous critics of the hypothesis of man-caused global warming. He has now got a book out that he's edited. It's called Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. He is also being sued by Michael Mann, who is the author of the famous or infamous hockey stick graph, which we can talk about later. And also, he's been going to presenting at several international conferences on climate change. He gave a talk there last summer. So he's eminently well qualified to speak on these topics. And so, Dr. Ball, again, welcome. It's great to talk to you again. Could we perhaps start with your book, and you could tell us a little bit about it, and then we can get into the lawsuit and the International Conference on Climate Change and wherever else we wind up going.
Fine. Thank you, Eric, and thanks for this 9th opportunity. That's amazing. Yeah. Hello.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we're fine. And Dr. Ball, I want to welcome you, too, back.
This reminds me of my early days of search and rescue in the Arctic when there was no GPS and there was no radio communication. So it was all this kind of bouncing off the ionosphere kind of communications. But thanks for this opportunity. And, of course, a lot has happened since we last talked because the hypothesis, the major problem that's occurred with this whole issue is that a hypothesis was created that said that a human production of CO2 would cause an increase in atmospheric levels, and as that level increased, the global temperature would go up. And contrary to the normal scientific method, as we've talked about in the past,
great. We've got Dr. Tim Ball and Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and Eric is our co-host this evening, and Dr. Ball is our guest.
Okay, well, just before we turn it over to Dr. Ball to tell us about his new book and his lawsuit and his recent activities in regards to the man-caused global warming hypothesis, I just also mention that I've also put in a career as a geography professor, teaching physical geography at
three different universities. Dr. Ball also taught in geography departments, so I'll make a slight plug for geography as a discipline which allows students to get kind of an overview of the physical sciences, including climate, weather, landforms or geomorphology, soils and biogeography on the physical side, and then cultural geography, of course, deals with humans. Put the two together and you can start to look at how humans are impacting the environment, how the environment impacts humans, and it really is an ideal subject, discipline, to give perspective on this. I'll say also that I have a website, www.naturalclimatechange.us, which, and, you know, I've posted a lot of the interviews we've had done with Dr. Ball in the past, as well as summarizing some of them, as well as many, many articles that I've written. So with that, a little plug for geography. Dr. Ball, could you tell us, could you bring us up to date on your book and other recent events?
Yes, thank you, Eric, and I'll join you in the support of geography as a discipline. It's been one of the things that's happened with me is that they've tried to say, oh, well, he's just a geographer and he doesn't know anything about climate. And I would agree with you. Geography is a bit of an anomaly in today's world because it's the original integrative discipline. That is, it's trying to bring together many pieces of a puzzle to get a much better picture of what's going on. And in this age of specialization, it's been a huge problem. And in fact, when I first started studying climate and got my PhD, they didn't know where to put a climatologist. Because you were a generalist, so you ended up in a geography department. It was a natural place for you to be. And this is part of the issue that we've been discussing with climate change and with the exploitation of it by political people and so on. And in this age of specialization, the analogy I like to use for climate, which is a generalist study, is that a lot of people have got specialist pieces of the puzzle, but nobody's got the box top. And the geographers, particularly those that are teaching climate in the geography discipline, are trying to put the pieces of the puzzle back together and finding out which pieces don't fit, which pieces are missing. And to carry that analogy a bit further, I would point out that in terms of our climate puzzle, we don't even have the accurate shape and size of the four corner pieces, which, of course, is the way that you put a puzzle together. You find the corner pieces first. And the corner pieces, of course, are the space, the sun, the atmosphere, the oceans, and the lithosphere. And our knowledge about those and their role in climate is very limited. And then the next thing you do with a puzzle is find the edge pieces. Well, we've got very few of the edge pieces of the climate puzzle. And the other thing you do in a puzzle is pile up all the different colored pieces. So you say, okay, what goes in the oceanography pile and what goes into the land surface pile and so on. So I think the criticism of people, putting down geography, it's being done by these specialists who think that somehow they're superior because that they are experts in one particular area. But the reality is when you stand outside, and we have discussed this before, when you experience weather, and climate, of course, is the average of the weather, but when you stand out and experience the weather, you're experiencing a product that is a total of everything from cosmic radiation in deep space to geothermal heat off the bottom of the oceans and everything in between. And so to bring all of that together and try and make some sense out of it to understand the weather is an enormous problem. And the IPCC don't even come close to including many of the critical pieces of the puzzle. And so, of course, their chances of achieving anything scientifically are virtually zero.
Yeah, excuse me, can I just interject here? The other book, other than yours, that I really like is by a paleoclimatologist by the name of Professor Robert M. Carter. who wrote a book called Climate, the Counter Consensus. And interestingly enough, I was going to use his book and your book in my climatology class this fall at the university that I just retired from. His book was written in 2010, but already it's out of print. Your book, I think, is written in 2011. But it's so far, I think they're still printing it. But this is a very, very hot topic, and there are powerful forces, powerful economic forces that do not want the counter-arguments to be available. And I thought your book and Carter's book were so excellent at that.
Well, exactly, and of course it is those forces. But just to expand on that point a little bit more about the subject of climatology, if you wanted to work for a weather office, a national weather office, whether it was NOAA or the Environment Canada or the UK Met Office, they required you to have a master's in physics. And the reason for that was, of course, that what you were going to do in the weather office was meteorology, not climatology. And this is another part of the problem with people understanding what's going on. And meteorology, of course, is the study of the physics of the atmosphere. But in order to understand the weather completely, particularly how it changes over time, you need to understand the input of the oceans, the input of changing sunlight, and all of these other factors. And traditionally, and when I started studying climate, in the weather offices, if you didn't want to be a forecaster anymore, they said, well, you can go in the back office and produce the monthly climate summaries. It was a sort of a sideways promotion, but it was seen as a chore. And of course, we've got the problem that the inadequate records that we've got are plaguing us today. But all of this speaks to why the role of geography and climatology as generalist disciplines of putting the pieces back together again, that we've taken the world apart, but we don't know how to put it back together again. And it isn't just in climate and that sort of study. It's a problem that the public have. For example, I've done a lot of work with farmers. Well, being a farmer is a generalist. And you have to know about soils, you have to know about the weather, you have to know about markets, you have to know about chemicals, and on and on and on. And I remember one farmer saying to me, you know, he said, I had a problem, my soils were not working right. And I went to the university and I said, I want to talk to somebody about soils. And they said, oh, we don't have anybody that studies soils. If you want to talk to, we got a guy that specializes in nematodes, the little worms that work in the soil, and we got somebody that can talk to you about trace minerals, or zinc, but we got no soils expert. And of course the guy ends up with the chemical companies that are going to sell him products that will improve his soils, because there's nowhere else to go. And that's an illustration of the problem that we've got, is finding somebody that can oversee the whole pattern. Now, where we also see it, of course, is in the law, where lawyers are suddenly expected to deal with lawsuits on some very, very complicated issues, and yet most of them are art students and not even scientists. So the whole issue of climate and the specialization and probably the last universal person was Alexander von Humboldt, who was a geographer, and he traveled to every continent in the world and reported on them, wrote about them, and theorized about them. The only continent he didn't go to was Antarctica, because it had only been discovered in 1840, and he died by 1859. But von Humboldt produced theories about climate, for example. He was the one that produced the theory about how, as you go up the mountainside in South America, it's the same as going from the equator to the pole in climatic zones. But von Humboldt knew all of the chemistry, all of the physics, all of the math, all of the science that was known at that time. He died in 1859, which is interesting. interestingly, the year that Origin of Species was produced. But since that time, the volume of information has just been overwhelming. And it's so much now that no one person could possibly encompass it all. And yet, we've got people that are still trying to function like the farmer as a generalist producing a crop in a very specialized world. And it creates a lot of difficulties, and nowhere have I seen it more than in the climate issue, now that it got into the political arena. And so, of course, what it also ran into was that, and I say that the ridicule of that I've received, saying, oh, well, you know, he's a geographer, or he taught in a geography department. I'm very proud of that. I don't, they're like Eric.
Yeah, I'm proud of that too. And I got my PhD at the University of Calgary, so I'm well right. aware that in Canada, which of yeah. course is still, well, was a Commonwealth country, still connected to England, it's geography is much more of a mainstream discipline than it is in the United States. And most yeah. of the former Commonwealth countries and Britain emphasized geography more. We had two yeah. floors in a large building for the geography department, and there were two floors for geology. We had 17 professors and many PhD and master's students. So, yep. you know, it was deemed an important discipline, and the science coming out of geography stood up with the science in any other discipline.
Right.
So it was not deemed to be somehow academically inferior. In fact, a lot of the professors were from the UK, et cetera.
And by the way, Eric, just to illustrate that point, geography is the only discipline that I know of that offers both BA arts degrees and science degrees in the same department.
Right.
Because, as you know, there's the physical geography, which you and I specialized in, and then there's the cultural geography. And, of course, that's one of the things I've always argued about is that geography is the stage and history is the play that's played out on that stage. And unless you integrate the two, you really don't understand human behavior and the pattern of things. But another interesting point to illustrate this division of knowledge is that geomorphology, which is the study of the surface of the Earth, in Britain, it's in geography departments. In the United States, it's in geology departments.
Or geography. I taught geomorphology all my career in geography programs.
Okay,
but
good.
Sometimes it's cross-listed with geology.
Geology
is punting geomorphology to a large extent. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, but of course, what's interesting is that the time scale for geologists, because geomorphology, the land surface, is really what's been created in the last 2,000-3,000 years, particularly if you've been under glaciation.
Which is the ice ages, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that doesn't fit with the geologic time scale where you're getting into millions of years. And so these are all part of the difficulties of disciplines and distribution and study. And by the way, that's one of the problems that we have is that, and I've dealt with school curriculums in Canada throughout my career, there's been a big fight, and I understand from some Americans that the same problem down there, that the school curriculum puts climate into the social science curriculum.
Yeah.
When it requires some scientific understanding, and so the science teachers want to get it into their curriculum, but it isn't allowed. And so what you end up in the social sciences, of course, is it becomes a purely political discussion, but it's essentially a discussion in ignorance. And this is another part of the problem.
Yeah, and Dr. Carter, Professor Carter, discusses yep. this aspect, too, you know, there's probably 100 different disciplines which pertain to climatology because,
yep.
of course, it is so vast in its scope. And so each one of those disciplines then would be willing and anxious to say, you know, me, I want your grant money.
Right.
I'm an expert. And if we yep. look at, say, some of the principles in the politically driven issue of man-caused climate change, We see James Hansen, of course, Al Gore's ally with NASA, who is an astronomer by training, right? And
yeah,
we
exactly.
See Tom Wigley, who comes out of Britain and was part of the East Anglia Climate Research Group early on, and then came to the National Center for Atmospheric Research, where I believe he now runs that. His background is in what, computer modeling?
Computer modeling. Yeah. Now that's an important point.
So here's the guy with, you know, says he's a scientist. He's a computer modeler. Well, you know, another point that Carter makes is that these models that are used in the United Nations IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, these are deterministic models, which means that they presume to understand everything about the climate system. And yet, all of the experts would say they don't understand nearly enough about the climate system to make valid predictions, or they call them projections or scenarios. They don't. There's no way we can make deterministic projections because we don't understand the system well enough to have all the numbers that would go into the greatest computers that could possibly be conceived.
Yeah. Well, one of the points about that is, of course, that Wigley was hired by Hubert Lam at East Anglia, and if you read Lam's autobiography on page 203, he talks about a couple of things. One was, of course, the fact that the reason he set up East Anglia was because he said, until we've got an adequate database of how climate has changed in the past and is changing now, we can't possibly start to try and determine the mechanisms that are causing those changes. And so he set up the East Anglia for that reason. Interestingly, the Weather Office, the UK Met Office that he had worked at, were simply not interested in funding anything like that. And that goes back to my earlier comment about, we're meteorologists, we're not climatologists. And Lam, of course, then made the fatal mistake as an Englishman of taking money from America to help set up the unit. Interestingly and ironically, of course, some of that money came from Shell Oil, but nonetheless. But then he realized that in order to cope with the sheer volume of data that was necessary, he needed somebody with some computer expertise. And he makes some very acerbic comments about hiring Tom Wigley, and in fact blames Wigley for losing quite a large contract with the Rockefeller Foundation, and so Wigley essentially took over. And the last time I visited Lam at East Anglia, he was just being allowed to come in each day, and they almost cynically referred to him as the professor. And it was very sad to see. But I would argue that Lam's argument that we don't have the database to even come close to building the models is still very true. But what happened with Wigley and others, because Michael Mann is a computer modeler as well, is I watched the modelers take over climate science. And it got to the point where you could not go to a climate conference where the keynote speaker wasn't a climate modeler, and they just came in and dictated to everybody. Now they started fighting amongst themselves because it became an argument as to who had the biggest and the fastest and most powerful computer. And I remember when the Cray computer came in, and the people that got access to that claimed that they had superior models, and their work was much better. But the reality is, we still don't have the computer capacity to create a model of climate that comes anywhere close to the natural condition. And so the dominance of computer modeling into climate science is what has caused so much of the problem. And I remember at a conference in Edmonton in 1989 when I think of his name now, it wasn't Schneider, but I'll think of it after, but he was from Northwestern University, and he came in and he got up and he gave a talk about how he had run the five major computer models and put the same data into each, and he showed the results. Well, the results were so different. One showed North America getting much colder, another one showed it getting much warmer, and he said, well, yeah, they don't agree regionally. He said, well, okay, a region is a whole continent. This is ridiculous. But he said they all show that the temperature will increase. Well, of course they did, because they were programmed that way. Yeah. And a fellow got up at the end. I mean, people were shouting and yelling at him, and it was interesting because the minister who had organized the conference said, well, you're telling me that Alberta is going to be a desert in 50 years, and I need to plant trees. You're telling me I shouldn't even bother. What's the accuracy of your forecast? And the presenter said 50-50, and the minister said, I need 98%. 50-50 doesn't cut it for me. And, of course, that's part of the problem, Eric, that we've seen going on with these computer models. You made the point just a little while ago that they started out making predictions. But then, because their predictions were immediately wrong, and all of them have been wrong, they stopped calling them predictions, they started calling them scenarios. And that's one of the giveaways in the history of climate science as it's evolved, is that instead of going back to the original hypothesis that CO2 increase will cause a temperature increase, they simply move the goalposts. So they started out talking about that it was going to cause global warming, and then when the CO2 kept going up and the temperature started going down, as Carter and others have pointed out, they stopped talking about warming and started calling it climate change. They stopped calling them predictions and said, oh, no, these are scenarios. But even the lowest temperature increase scenario has not has been wrong. The temperature's gone down, not up. And so, and of course, that's key to this whole thing, because a simple definition of science is the ability to predict.
Okay, can
if
I
you
ask?
Cannot predict, you do not have science. And of course, this got into the issue, the debate that went on when people like myself and Richard Lindzen and others were saying, well, look, you can't forecast the weather for beyond 5 days, and yet you're so definitive about what's going to happen 50 and 100 years from now. They came back with the argument, and Hansen and others were pushing this argument, that, oh, well, there's a difference between weather and climate. Well, we've already discussed that a little bit, but the reality is there isn't any difference, because the climate is the average of the weather. So if your weather's wrong, then your climate is going to be wrong. But this was another of the ploys that they put out there. And, of course, they know that the public are not that aware of these issues.
Yeah, and, if I could just interject here, yep. Tim. Of course, with computer models or just computer programs in general, the adage yep. that's well known to computer people yep. is garbage in, garbage out. If your data and your assumptions are not correct, there's no way that your conclusions can be correct. And it's a bit like, you know, the way we think. I mean, if we think rationally but start with the wrong assumptions, we'll probably come to the wrong conclusion.
Going back
to Carter, excuse me, Melody, if we go back to Carter, he starts his book very well, I think. He says, the problem we have now is there's three different realities. There's real reality, which is what scientists like you and I deal with when we talk about, you know, the Little Ice Age and the medieval warm period and the Holocene optimum and the late Wisconsin and the last interglacial, the Sangamon. And we know something about what's going on over time. Real science is keyed to observation tested in a scientific method. Then there's virtual reality, which is the reality of the climate models. And of course, this is what Tom Wigley and Phil Jones and all these IPCC politicos are wedded to. And then, to make matters even more confusing, we have the public reality, which is what the media tells us. And that's a little different yet. So again, I'm going to quote Michael Crichton, who wrote a great book I recommend to everybody called The State of Fear in 2003. He also gave a talk at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco called Environmentalism as Religion, which I recommend to everybody. You can download that on the internet. But here he says, the greatest challenge facing mankind is the challenge of distinguishing reality from fantasy, truth from propaganda. We must daily decide whether the threats we face are real, whether the solutions we are offered will do any good, whether the problems we're told exist are in fact real problems or non-problems. And of course, it's our contention that climate change, at least as it's presented by the media, is a non-problem. In fact, we've benefited from about 10,000 years of relatively stable warm climate. We call it the Holocene Epoch. During this time, agriculture developed and human civilization developed. And the climate has been much more benign and stable. And by the way, warm is better than cold for plants and animals and humans. And the previous periods were marked by very rapid and extreme climate changes. And most of the last 2 to 3 million years, the Ice Age, was considerably colder than now. And this was all natural. And if we go back before that, we see warmer intervals that are all naturally driven. And we see that 80% of the history of the Earth, there was no ice. And the temperature on the planet was considerably warmer, maybe 5 to 10 degrees centigrade warmer than now, with no tipping points reached. In fact, animals tend to get bigger, as do plants, because warmth, again, helps life thrive. So we're just told a pack of propaganda. And then, of course, the real interesting question, which maybe we can get to towards the end, is who's pushing the propaganda and why? I think that's where we really need to go. But I'm sorry, Melody, I cut you off. What was your question?
I was just wanting to point out the fact that when you're talking about these different models and the like, that if they're doing that in this kind of science, do we need to be kind of aware that this is across the board in other avenues, not just science, but in all disciplines?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Because, of course, you see, the computer is a new piece of technology. And as Jacob Bronowski in his wonderful series on The Ascent of Man pointed out, that the extent of our knowledge is a function of the technology that we have. For example, if you think about the influence of the telescope on the Galilean view of the world and so on, and then we start to see Hubble and what it's been doing. And certainly the computer, and I did mention that one of the reasons that Hubert Lam brought Tom Wigley in was because he realized that with the sheer volume of data, a computer could handle the data. The problem is when you start to get that computer to manipulate or play with that data, and the computer can't do that unless it's programmed to do that. And therefore, it will only produce what you program it to do. It's, by the way, this is a very fundamental issue in this day and age and in education that Eric's aware of, that at the lower levels, particularly K to 12, there's a real tendency to confuse knowledge and intelligence. And of course, a computer can have knowledge but not intelligence. And a child or a person can have intelligence but no knowledge. And so to assume that because a five-year-old doesn't know anything, that they're not intelligent, means you end up insulting the intelligence of that child. And my experience, and I'm sure Eric's found the same thing, is that most students are just bored silly in the schools. They're simply not intellectually challenged. And of course, Aristotle talked about these issues 2,000 years ago when he identified the difference between that he said you could have a mathematical genius of 5 years old, but you couldn't have a philosophical genius of 5 years old, because one was a basic an innate ability of varying degrees, but the other required life experience to understand. And so he argued that you should go to school till you're 12 and then get out and get some life experience and go back to school when you're 40. Unfortunately, we've set up a system that doesn't accommodate that. And by the way, that's a very important point, and I know Eric would agree with this. When you look at, we'll talk about how the scientific method and how they thwarted that, but the supporters of the IPCC and the global warming hypothesis and so on are all younger people. The skeptics are all older people. When I think of Fred Singer, who's close to, I think in his 80s, and you think of Richard Lindzen towards the end of his career, certainly me, and Bob Carter.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and that contradicts what usually went on. Normally what went on was you had the old guard, the old professors with the prevailing wisdoms, and then the new young people came in and challenged those. Now it's exactly the opposite. The new young people are coming in imbued with that environmental religion view, but it's the old guard that are saying, hang on a minute, science is never settled. But these people are coming into the system believing the science is settled. They've been indoctrinated by Al Gore and the gang. And so they've turned everything upside down.
Yeah. Fred Singer, you mentioned, also has been involved with these Heartland Institute conferences that you were involved with last summer, which, by the way, I was thinking of coming to that, but then I found out you could watch it on the computer and that the lectures... the presentations were and are available. So go to the Heartland Institute if you want to see some excellent presentations on this, as well as PowerPoint presentations from previous years. There have been now six. But one of the a good way for people to kind of get the opposite viewpoint is to go on the internet and watch the Great Global Warming Swindle. All you have to do is type in the Great Global Warming Swindle. It's a Martin Durkin special, an hour long, 2007. It features some of these older skeptics like Fred Singer, who wrote Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1,500 Years, and Dr. Tim Ball, and Professor Carter, and many others. Richard Lindzen, MIT meteorologist, who's got lots of good one-liners like... the science was settled before the research began,
mm-hmm.
because there's a political agenda, as we've talked about before. But, so anyway, I just wanted to interject. There are many books now that can be got from Amazon.com. Let's go talk about your book, Tim. You've got this chapter in here about global warming alarmism. You talk about Tom Wigley and the Climate Research Institute at East Anglia, which, by the way, is where ClimateGate occurred, all those leaked emails that showed corruption of the scientific process. You've got a long chapter here called Analysis of Climate Alarmism. Could you kind of summarize what you found there?
Yeah, just to fill out a couple of your earlier comments, and I'll get to the book. But I had the privilege of being a keynote speaker with Fred Singer at the first Heartland in New York, and that was a great honor because Fred has been in the wars even longer than I have, and so that was part of the honor, and the Heartland, by the way, was the first group to have a skeptics conference. The keynote speaker for that was Vaclav Klaus, who's the only world leader who has consistently pointed out what's been going on with the abuse and the use of environmentalism, particularly climate change. But anyway, one of the things that I understand that you watch the Heartland through the computer, but one of the advantages of being there was that there was two different things going on, and this is an interesting part of the development of science. Because up to now, Eric, we've had the two groups, the warmists, if you want to call them that, or the pro-AGW, anthropogenic global warming group, and then the skeptics. But what, of course, we all know, and this is a kind of a crude analogy, if you want, but it's one that most people can relate to, with sexuality, we had homosexuality, now we're coming to terms, heterosexuality, now we're coming to terms with homosexuality. The reality is there's a complete gradation of sexualities. And so there are starting to be, and I think it's very healthy, schisms appearing amongst the skeptics. And that is, of course, the way science should work. The fact that there are no schisms appearing amongst the warmists shows that it's a political view that, that if you're not with me, you must be against me kind of attitude in politics.
Yeah.
Ideology, right. And so one of the things that was discussed, and I was approached by several different groups to go and talk with them. One of them, by the way, I was invited to a breakfast meeting with by Harrison Schmitt, who was the last astronaut to stand on the moon. And he had brought a group of engineers, and they had just they all introduced themselves and said they were complete neophytes to climate change, but they started to look at the fundamental physics of CO2 as a greenhouse gas and said, this is absolute scientific rubbish. And that was a theme that was starting to develop. Now, one of the problems I've had all along as a skeptic is that there were a lot of questions I had, but rather than create too many problems early in the attempts to get the truth out there, I kind of kept them to myself. But one of the questions, as you know, Eric, that I've been pushing for some time is that would somebody please show me a record in which the CO2 goes up before the temperature goes up? Because the fundamental assumption of global warming due to human activity is that human activity, industry particularly, will produce more CO2. More CO2 in the atmosphere will cause the temperature to rise. And I remember back in 1991 when the first ice core records came out by Pettit and Jousel and those people. And I had been working with ice core people, Fritz Kerner, up on Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic. And Fritz was telling me, and this was late 80s, he was telling me, look, my record's showing that the temperature's going up before the CO2. And when this record came out from the ice cores, they immediately leapt on it and said, oh, there it is, the temperature's going up and down, the CO2's going up and down, there's proof that CO2's driving temperature. Jousel, the Frenchman who was producing some of that work, gave a warning. He said, look, don't rush to judgment. What you got here is a graph that covers 4.5 inches across a page, yet it's 400,000 years, and so the subtleties of the graph were simply not visible there. And of course, what it turned out was that the graph showed that the temperature increased before the CO2, which completely undermined the fundamental assumption of the AGW hypothesis. And, of course, that's what Lindzen was also talking about, that here was a hypothesis that was put out, and as Lindzen said and wrote about it in Discover magazine, the consensus was reached before the research had even begun. And of course, then what happened was anybody that dared to practice proper science, and that is try to disprove the theory, was immediately isolated and attacked as a skeptic and then later a denier. And so the whole idea of what's been going on, it illustrates the problem. Now, as I said, at the Heartland in Washington this summer, there were these groups that were discussing this issue about whether or not CO2 is a greenhouse gas at all. Now, when John O'Sullivan, who's a climate skeptic and a lawyer out of England, and specializes in the law, in getting through the layers to who's manipulating, who's controlling, how is this being done? And we see this occurring in the world every day. And of course, he got down to to people like Michael Mann and all of these other people that were controlling the record. And so the idea that CO2 is even a greenhouse gas at all is under serious question. So when John O'Sullivan talked to me about, he said, look, I've got some physicists, particularly Joe Postma and a couple of other people, that say the physics of CO2 as a greenhouse gas simply doesn't hold up. So here's specialists pointing to one critical part and saying, look, that part doesn't work. Now, what interested me about that, Eric, was that, and you mentioned earlier, the hockey stick. It was a statistician, another of those specialists that we talked about earlier in this program, who, by the name of Steve McIntyre, he was at a conference. McIntyre's career had involved looking at graphs of mining claims. And his job as a forensic statistician was to look at these graphs and say, is the data accurate? Is it presented accurately? Well, he saw the hockey stick graph at this conference. He didn't even know it was a climate graph. And he immediately knew it was phony. He immediately knew how it had been created and what had been done. Well, then he started to dig into it more and more. And, of course, so here was a specialist looking at that graph. Now, I wouldn't have known that. I looked at the graph and I said, well, okay, he's plotted the data. I had problems with the graph, not because of how he plotted the graph or the statistics, but the problem I had was they were claiming that tree rings represented temperature, and I know that tree rings represent precipitation far more than they represent temperature, but that got bypassed in the process. So when I got the opportunity to find another group of specialists,
if you could just hold that for a second, I'll just add to what you're saying that the hockey stick graph purports to show temperatures over the last 1,000 years. It's called the hockey stick because it's relatively flat, and then the temperature goes up in the last 50 years, just like the blade of a hockey stick. And Michael Mann got this published in an article in Nature, the Mann et al. I think it's Mann, Hughes, and Bradley, 1998 at Nature. And this graph was prominently featured in Al Gore's movie. It's in many, many, many university texts now. You can't get rid of this stupid thing, even though the Wegener Commission, which was authorized by Congress to look at this issue, more or less showed, just as you're saying, that it's phony. In fact, the early part of the record is taken from, what, about 12 trees in California, tree rings, and the rest of the world, the rest of the paleoclimatic record, is ignored to select that data. And in other words, there's an enormous selection of data. It's what's called a time series, where you show temperature going up and down over time. You're plotting it on a graph, and of course, this is what climatologists have been doing for a long time. And many of us have looked at many, 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 many records, but somehow this hockey stick graph, you go to text after text, I see it in intro physical geography texts, and I decide right then and there, I don't want anything to do with that text. I mean, the rest of the text might be pretty good, but this is, you know, phony as a $3 bill. But go ahead.
And of course, the other issue was, as a historical climatologist, and that was what I was working with Lam on, because that was what he was doing, was getting historic records and reconstructing the climate conditions of the past. We knew, and in fact, Lam called, he created the names of the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age, which was the temperature bottomed out around 1680. Well, of course, this graph of the hockey stick graph eliminated all of that. In other words, what they did was they literally rewrote history, the climate history, with this graph. And it was very interesting because there's a Professor Deming who Right. He'd written an article in Science about climate change, and he said that he got an email from somebody who clearly thought that he was part of this group that were prepared to politicize and distort climate science for their agenda. And in the email, the person said, "We have to get rid of the medieval warm period."
Yeah,
well,
which shows
of course,
that temperatures were warmer 1,000 years ago than
right.
they are today, and nobody was driving cars. So,
okay.
In other words, natural climate change. Yeah,
and that was the problem, because, you see, they were saying, well, you know, the late 20th century is the warmest it's ever been, and people like Lindzen and myself were standing up and saying, "But and Willie Soon, by the way, of course, and Sally Baliunas were others, were standing up and saying, well, hang on a minute, it was much warmer back in the medieval warm period 1,000 years ago when the Vikings were sailing in Arctic waters that are now permanent pack ice. So it was fact that contradicted the theory that they wanted to push, so they set about rewriting the history, and they did it with a hockey stick.
Okay, gentlemen.
Well, of course, the idea of... sorry, Melody, were you trying to...
Well, I'm at some point, if you want to finish your point, but I do need to take... care of some top of the hour.
Okay. I'll wind it up, and then we can come back to this point. But okay. But the idea of the Slaying the Dragon book was that here was another specialist area that was raising questions about the misuse of their specialist area in the general study of climate, and of course that's what. McIntyre and McKittrick had done when they broke the hockey stick, and one of the things I've been trying to do is get more and more specialists to look at how the climate scientists have misused their specialist area, and then we can finally put the whole thing to rest and get back to some decent science.
Okay, you're listening to KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest is Dr. Tim Ball. And I do want to say that these programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And we also have a website for Dr. Tim Ball. It's drtimball.com. And then we also have a website for Dr. Carlstrom. It's one of them is www.naturalclimatechange.us. Where is this all leading, and why would this even be happening? That's my question. Dr. Ball.
Okay. Thanks, Melody. Yeah, and by the way, my website is drtimball. So it's all lowercase, Dr. Tim Ball. So drtimball. Of course, that's one of the questions that is starting to become asked more and more often. I did a program out of California this morning, and one of the phone-in questions was, what was the motive? Why has this been done? How has it been done? And of course, that, as people start to realize that the science has been corrupted, and part of the reason that they're starting to question it beyond the leaked emails that Eric talked about from East Anglia and the broken hockey stick and so on is the cold weather, of course, the illogic where they're trying to say, oh, well, the snow and the cold is due to warming. That's so illogical, even the people that don't understand science are saying, well, hang on a minute. And there's a lovely old English saying is that I'm not as green as I am cabbage looking. But the motive becomes the next issue, and that's what my next book hopefully will be about. I do talk about it briefly in my chapter in the Slaying the Sky Dragon, because what I do in that book is try to raise this issue about climate as a generalist discipline, and then the special subject areas that are all brought together. And I know that Eric, like me, as a generalist, if I have to do anything, for example, whenever I use statistics, I've got a fundamental ability with it, but I always go to the specialist and say, look, am I doing this right? How should I do this? The key thing is that I know to ask the right questions and I know to understand what they're telling me. But it's impossible to be a climatologist and not rely on all of these specialists and what they're saying. The question is, how do you fit the piece of the puzzle together? Now, back to your original point about the motive. One of the things that I urge people to think about is that in the great complexity that is the weather, whether it's cosmic radiation, whether it's the sun, or whether it's heat from the oceans, or whatever it is, dust in the atmosphere, CO2 as a gas, and so on, there are a multitude of things that can change the weather, and therefore the climate over time. And they need to ask themselves, why has the focus become CO2? Now, it isn't even the most important greenhouse gas, and as I mentioned before, there's a lot of debate, and there's a lot of people thinking that it isn't even a greenhouse gas at all. And even if we consider it a greenhouse gas, it is still less than 4% of the greenhouse gases. And water vapor is 95% of the greenhouse gases by volume, and it's a far more important greenhouse gas. Now, most people know that because the difference when you get clear skies at night in the fall or the spring, the heat escapes and the temperature drops and you'll get frost. But in the if you've got cloud cover or high humidity, then the temperature doesn't drop as much. You get the same in the desert. Phoenix, you can get extremely high daytime temperatures, and then because of very low water vapor, the heat escapes and the temperature drops dramatically. That is, it's not nothing to do with CO2. It's everything to do with water vapor. So the question becomes then, how did they get everybody focused on CO2? And the analogy that I use, that not a particularly good one, but people can relate to, it's like the doctor saying, well, I'm going to do a complete physical and write up a health report on Dr. Eric. And, oh, but to save time and money, I'm only going to look at this one wart on his left arm. And then you write a report saying that Dr. Eric is a small, brown, wizened person with a high tendency to cancer. Well, that's essentially what they've done by just focusing on CO2. And one of the things that people don't realize, and I don't remember if we've talked about this before, but it's worth going through again. One of the things that I've learned by being a geographer and working trying to resolve problems in the real world is that I've served on various commissions, the Manitoba Water Commission. I chaired a commission trying to come up with a management strategy for an entire river drainage basin. And of course, there you're bringing all these pieces together and trying to integrate them. So I learned very early that what appeared like a good political solution was, okay, we've got this problem, and there's conflict over it. And I thought, oh, the politicians come along and they say, oh, great, we'll assign a commission to look at the problem or determine what the issue is. And you think, oh, great, we're getting politics out of it. We're going to get the facts. And I thought that up until I was appointed to my first commission of inquiry. It happened to be a conflict over a lake level of a prairie lake in Manitoba. And the lake levels were fluctuating, and people were fighting and arguing, and water, by the way, causes more conflict than virtually anything. I mean, children only greater. And so I was appointed to the commission to look at this water level in Dauphin Lake. And everybody said, oh, great. But then I realized very quickly how the government and the politicians kept control of everything, because they defined the problem. And they also set out the terms of reference of how the problem would be examined. And, of course, as soon as I looked at it, it even limited the access to data. And so I went to the chairman of the commission, Mr. Duncan, and I said, Mr. Duncan, we can't possibly even start to look at this problem unless we get access to all the data. And he said, well, the government won't allow that. And I said, well, then fine. I'll go to the media and say that the government have appointed us as a commission and then are trying to control us by the terms of reference. And so I now know that every time a government appoints a commission, it is controlled. And the classic example, of course, is the Warren Commission in the U.S. looking at the Kennedy assassination. And I so vividly remember an interview with Judge Warren, who was appointed before he died. And the interviewer said, well, why didn't you look at the mafia connection with Jack Ruby and Dallas? And his simple answer was, it wasn't in my terms of reference. Well, most people, that would just sort of slide by, and it wouldn't mean anything to them. I knew, because of my experience, what he was saying was, he got the word, hands off, you don't look in that area. And of course, this is the issue with regard to setting up of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They organized that committee or panel to look at climate change, but then Maurice Strong, who wrote who set that up through the United Nations, wrote the definition of climate change, which was restricted to only those climate changes caused by humans. So in other words, they don't even look at natural causes. And then it was narrowed even further in the terms of reference. And so the Intergovernmental Panel then produced these reports, which are put out to the world as if they are a definitive analysis of all climate change and all climate change mechanisms, when in fact they're only looking at human causes of change. And of course the reason for that was that they wanted to show that human CO2 was causing climate change and was destroying the planet. Now, why did that come about? Well, Maurice Strong was a member of the Club of Rome, which, of course, Paul Ehrlich and other people were involved with. And they wrote, they came out with, and here we come back to the computer analysis, Eric. They were the first to try and do trend analysis projecting into the future. If we continue this path, where will we end up? And they published it in a book called Limits to Growth. And the book was arguing that, and it was an extension of the Malthusian argument that the world's overpopulated, and that issue came up just the other day when they said the world's reached 7 billion population, but that the Malthusian argument was that the population would outgrow the food supply. The Club of Rome expanded that to say not only would it outgrow the food supply, but because it was now industrialized, it would exhaust all of the resources, and the world would collapse. And of course, that idea came about that the problem of the world then is capitalism, because it is causing an increase in lifestyle that is putting too many demands on the resources of the world. Now, there's a very interesting part of this, because an economist by the name of Julian Simon, who was very suspicious of computer models from right from the start, made a bet with Paul Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, and that was, the underlying theme, that, oh, the population's going to start growing and use more resources, and the predictions that Ehrlich made in that book were wrong so quickly and so badly, and yet he still got credibility. But Simon said to him, look, you pick any minerals that you want, and pick any time period you want, and I'll bet you that in the time period, the cost of those minerals will go down. Okay? And Simon then chose somebody to pick some minerals at a time period, at which he then presented to Simon. Now, Simon turned out to be correct. But here's the interesting aspect of it that ties into today's world, because the person that Ehrlich chose to select the minerals in the time period was a fellow by the name of John Holdren. And John Holdren, of course, is the science czar in the Obama White House today. And Holdren was publishing with Ehrlich in articles, and of course promoting the ideas of eugenics and population control and limits of family size and all these other frightening things. And of course the idea that the world was overpopulated and that the resources were going to be exhausted, and that's why you hear them talking about peak oil, and they're now starting to talk about peak water, and they're all absolute nonsense. But Morris Strong, who had been an industrialist, a Canadian who moved to the States, became an industrialist, but made a lot of money, and then he came out with the statement, and it was made in an interview with Elaine Dewar in a book called Cloak of Green, because Elaine Dewar was a reporter who wanted to write a book praising Canadian environmentalists, but the more she researched them, the more she discovered that they had a very narrow political agenda and were using the environmental issue in order to push their political agenda. And he said, Morris Strong said to Elaine Dewar, you know, the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? Now, he did it in a sort of a somewhat hypothetical way, but that was the thinking. And Dewar said to him, well, if you have that ambition, why don't you run for politics? Strong replied, you can't do anything as a politician, which might be a true statement, but he said, I'm going to go to the UN where I can get all the money I want and not be accountable to anybody. He then took off and to the UN and set up the United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, out of which came the United Nations Climate Commission, or Climate Change Committee, out of which came the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And, of course, as I say, he then wrote the terms of reference for that, which then restricted what they would look at. So the IPCC reports are presented as if they are the definitive studies of world climate, when, in fact, all they're doing is looking at CO2. Now, why are human causes? Now, why CO2? Well, if you take Strong's comment that we've got to get rid of the industrialized nations, how would you do that? One of the things that always amazes me looking at history is that people tell you what they plan to do if they ever get into power. I mean, the classic example of it, of course, was Hitler's Mein Kampf, which he published in 1933, in which he set out his agenda. What did we do? We banned the book. If you ever want an argument against banning anything, there it is. Because if people have been allowed to read it and question it, and challenged it, and not said it would have stopped it, but if people would at least know what was going on. And my experience is that if that's true of most people that end up doing things. The ideas formulate in their minds when they're young, quite often as a doctoral thesis, and then, of course, when they get into positions of power, they start to implement those ideas. And, of course, this is what Strong did. Now, how would you go about shutting down an industrialized nation? Well, if you compare the industrialized nation to the engine of a car, which runs on fossil fuels, that's a pretty good analogy with most nations today, you can stop the engine by squeezing the fuel line, stopping the fuel going into the car, and the engine will stop. But if you did that in a nation, people would scream immediately. It would be political suicide to do that. And you can see some of that now with limited energies for the United States because of the policies of the EPA and Obama and so on. But if you could show, and you could also stop the engine, by the way, by plugging the exhaust, that will stop the engine as well. So if you could show that the exhaust from that engine was destroying the planet, causing a massive runaway climate change that was going to destroy the planet, then you could say, hey, we need to control CO2, and therefore, through a back door, you are then going to shut down the industries and you're going to shut down the industrialized nations, which Morris Strong and the people at the Club of Rome saw as the problem. And so that's what's been driving all of this. That's the motive behind it. Now, the sad thing is that Strong was he set the IPCC up through the World Meteorological Organization. Because one of the things, and I've talked to people that grew up with Morris Strong, that worked for him, worked with him, and they said that the one talent that he had was he was a superb organizer of bureaucracies. And, of course, by setting the IPCC up through the World Meteorological Organization, then all of the people that were appointed to the IPCC came from national weather agencies. They were government employees. And of course, they did what their governments told them to do. And so this is why you see that the IPCC is dominated by bureaucrats, and you see the role of NOAA in this, and NASA with Hansen, and you see the Environment Canada. In fact, the Assistant Deputy Minister of Environment Canada chaired the first meeting of the IPCC at Villach, Austria. So that's the underlying motive. And, of course, what we've tried to stay focused on, and I helped set up a group called Friends of Science who wanted to fight the political battle, and I said, no, you'll lose the political battle every time. But what you've got to do is show that the science is faulty. And, of course, that's what people have been trying to do. Sorry, Eric, go ahead.
No, I think what you say is excellent. You've covered a lot of ground. If I could just add a couple things. I just retired from my teaching job at California State University, and I was going to use in my climatology class your book and Carter's book. I teach a human ecology class, and I was using Gorham's book, Climatism, which is an excellent book. Outlining the political and economic dimensions and energy dimensions of this. But the reason why I chose to retire right now, who is on the political spectrum now coming up with saying that global warming is a hoax? Well, it's people like Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin, people who are kind of on the far right of the political spectrum. So, you know, my students, you know, and there are a lot of Republicans in the Central Valley of California, you know, would automatically think that I am, you know, kind of politically allied with them, which I'm not, you know. So what I'm saying is people have a hard time distinguishing science and politics. So that's been very frustrating for me because, you know, we do need to look at the scientific issues. But then what's so fascinating about this is it's we've had science corrupted and co-opted by this political economic agenda that you outline. The Club of Rome is a think tank established in 1969 by the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations out of Britain, which was formed about World War I and really became the numero uno propaganda mass brainwashing center of the world, employing Sigmund Freud and then his nephew Edward Bernays, and they were really trying to figure out how you mass brainwash an entire population. This will be a subject of future interviews with Melody and I, the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations and the Club of Rome. Yeah, we can trace back these propaganda ploys. We can see other instances in which science has been corrupted by the ruling elite. The eugenics movement, for instance, heavily supported by the elite Rockefellers. The movement in Russia under communism. What's the name of that kind of alternative biology that caused many people to starve? Lysenkoism. This pseudoscientist named Lysenko. But let me quote Václav Klaus, the president of the Czech Republic and the new leader of the European Union. He said, "Man-made global warming is a hoax that threatens our future and the future of our children. Environmentalism is the new communism." Okay, talking about motives, Richard Lindzen, the meteorologist from MIT, said, "If you control carbon, you control life." And, of course, the 85% of the United States energy and the world's energy comes from fossil fuels, which, of course, when they're burned, produce CO2, which is not a pollutant. In fact, it makes plants grow better. As we all know, CO2 is an essential ingredient in photosynthesis. And yet the EPA has now been instructed by the Supreme Court to regulate it as a pollutant. Well, this is, you know, there are fingerprints of political manipulation on that. Marie Strong, as you mentioned, and we in the San Luis Valley of Colorado have a special interest in him because he came in as a director of the Arizona Land and Cattle Association, which was an old Spanish land grant, and tried to take the water from under our San Luis Valley and export it to Denver and make another $1 billion. Here's a Canadian now coming in to reap another billion off of our resources. He was driven out, but anyway, going back to motive, I've got some rather extensive things on this on my website. I've got a 80-page letter, disproofs of the hypothesis of AGW, anthropogenic global warming, and proofs that AGW is a fraud. That also, there's another one which is based on a presentation I did at the Commonwealth Club last spring called Man-Made Climate Change in the Skies or Playing God with the Atmosphere and the Earth. In that, and that's PowerPoint, it's on my website, naturalclimatechange.us, in that I make the point that the motive for this fraud, and it is a fraud because we see the scientific corruption, systematic scientific corruption. Marie Strong only has a ninth grade education. He's not a scientist. He's associated with the Rockefellers. He's a billionaire. He's one of the ruling elite of the world, supposedly in the Committee of 300, that is, you know, the secret government, the shadow government. But the real motive for this is associated with the United Nations, the whole business of carbon taxes and cap and trade schemes that were explored with the Kyoto Protocols in 1997, that called for originally, of course, that was not passed by the United States, ratified by the U.S., and was therefore not enacted at that time. But we've seen very similar laws being passed. The Global Warming Solutions Act in California of 2007 is very similar to the Kyoto Protocol. It calls for something like, you know, phase back of our use of fossil fuels so that we get 20% of our energy from renewables by 2020 and then 80% by 2050 or something like that. Well, this is physically impossible unless we start building nuclear power plants at an enormous rate. So what they're really talking about is deindustrializing. But meanwhile, the ruling elite wants to get very rich on this. Al Gore, of course, has become a billionaire with his General Investment Corporation. And one of his allied corporations, and Melody sent me the link on this, one of his allied kind of partnerships is called the Carbon Disclosure Project. I'll read this. The Carbon Disclosure Project provides a secretariat for the world's largest institutional investor collaboration on the business implications of climate change, now representing $31 trillion of assets under management. CD, $31 trillion, that's like, you know, like 80% of the world's economy. Well, that's because, you know, fossil fuels drives 85% of the world's economy. CDP represents a process whereby institutional investors collectively sign a single global request for disclosure of information on greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so this whole thing is a huge train. You and I have watched it coming down the track. Plan A, of course, it's called Plan A by our politicians, is to, put heavy taxes on all activities by human beings, perhaps, you know, energy-related, transportation-related, heating and cooling-related, perhaps even breathing eventually, because we all exhale CO2. But what came out of the Copenhagen conference in just last year, I guess, 2009, was that they weren't making much progress. So then our science czar, John Holdren, said, well, we're just going to have to look at Plan B. We can't take anything off the table. Plan A is not working. That's carbon taxes. And Plan B, what's Plan B? Well, geoengineering. We're hearing a lot from the Royal Society in Britain and all kinds of places. Even now, they define geoengineering as the human manipulation of the climate to combat man-caused global warming. So So they've set up a problem or a non-problem as a problem and then said, okay, we have to solve this problem or non-problem solar radiation management strategies. In other words, we're going to make artificial clouds high in the sky, which they've been doing for two decades now, by the way. If people will bother to look up in the sky, they will see NASA admits they have jet cirrus clouds. These are high clouds, which are thin clouds that are formed by the kind of the spreading out of the aerosols that these jets have, military and passenger jets and others, have been spraying into the sky all over the world, all over the world. Geoengineering is plan B. Okay, what's the real goal of geoengineering? Well, does it have anything to do with something like the population reduction strategies that John Holdren was advocating with Ehrlich in the early 70s? We have to ask these questions. We have to wake up very quickly because at the official level, there is only denial. No, there's nothing going on. Those are normal jet contrails. Well, they're not normal jet contrails. Normal jet contrails disappear within, you know, a minute because it's just water vapor turning into ice and then dissipating. These things are aerosols. They're aluminum oxides, barium oxides, strontium oxides. That in fact are metallic oxides that are changing the nature of our atmosphere. We have now many academics who are writing papers on geoengineering. These people all use the man-caused global warming non-problem as a justification. And many of these people, like David Keith, University of Calgary, are invested in capitalistic ventures, which will make them a lot of money spraying this and that and the other. Well, this, you know, again, I've got this a lot of information on a website, on my website, in this PowerPoint. Melody and I have talked about this once on an interview on her show. We're going to do it again next Tuesday night if anybody's interested. I personally think that carbon taxes are very potentially damaging, again, could destroy the industrialized nations. I think the geoengineering is potentially more damaging in the sense that who knows what the implications of these many projects are to life itself.
Can I just state that, you know, this is kind of the time to be connecting the dots because there are a lot of anomalies or things that are taking place around us, and it's time that we really start trying to figure out what and discussing it, and this is why, you know, we're having these this forum with this radio program, and one of the things that flies in the face of all of this is those that are setting these programs up and setting the system up are over in other countries like China and Singapore and the like, doing just the opposite by industrializing the heck out of them.
Yeah, China and India have not been included in the Kyoto Protocol solution, which of course means that whatever phase out of fossil fuel use we do would have, you know, no impact on the global CO2. And as Tim has pointed out in past interviews, in the geologic past, CO2 has been far higher than it is now, maybe 10 times, even 20 times higher than it is now, and that indeed modern plants evolved with maybe, you know, 8 to 10 times more CO2 in the atmosphere. So this is not a dangerous situation at all. In fact, it's good for plants,
okay,
and it's good for life.
One question I have is, this is just me, but isn't it more likely that we're having less oxygen in the atmosphere?
That's a very good question because, of course, we talk about CO2 in percentage terms, and we talk about gases in the atmosphere as percentages. So if you increase the percentage of one, that's got to decrease the percentage of the other, but it doesn't necessarily deplete the absolute amount because the atmosphere is not a fixed or rigid container. And one of the issues, and just to give you an idea of how complex the whole climate issue is, and one of the reasons, by the way, that NASA got so involved in it is NASA, first of all, were afraid that they were going to be accused of causing climate change with their exhaust gases and so on, but also the depth of the atmosphere is very critical in terms of the frictional effect that it has on space vehicles orbiting the Earth. And we recently had that German satellite that came down. The big one, of course, was Skylab a few years ago. And the reason Skylab came down was they miscalculated the temperature of the Earth and how thick the atmosphere would be, and therefore there was more frictional effect on the space vehicle, which of course slows it down, and its speed in orbit determines its ability to stay in orbit. And they couldn't get up there in time to boost it in speed and into a higher orbit. And so as the temperature of the Earth varies, then this gaseous envelope expands and contracts, and therefore the density of the gases varies as well as their percentage. And to illustrate that, Melody, I was absolutely stunned when I first learned this, and it was one of the first introductions to the problem of specialization. We had a vice president who was studying the impact of nuclear bomb explosions in the atmosphere back in the 60s and 70s. And I was sitting having coffee with him one day and found out that he didn't know that the depth of the atmosphere in which most of the weather occurs, what we call the tropopause, or troposphere, I should say, is twice as deep over the equator as it is at the poles. So the atmosphere is half the depth over the poles as it is at the equator. And he didn't know that, yet here he was studying how these nuclear explosions and the gases were going to be distributed in the Earth's atmospheric system. And there are very few people know that. Now the main reason for the difference, of course, is the equator is much hotter than the poles, and air, dense air contracts. But the other reason is the centrifugal force, that as the atmosphere and the Earth spin, it's thrown away from the Earth slightly. There's a bulge with it. And so these are simple things that most people don't understand at all, but have great implication for much of what goes on. Just to sort of pick up on a couple of things John said. One of course, is the idea that if you are against the anthropogenic global warming theory, then you are right wing, and if you're for it, you're left wing. All that does to me is illustrate how political this whole issue has become.
Right.
And I've had a lot of scientists say to me, look, we agree with you, but we're socialists. In Canada, that's quite an acceptable thing, and they say we don't want to be branded as right wing, which would happen if we came out and publicly said we agree with you,
right.
And to me that kind of intimidation is really quite disturbing, and of course it also speaks to freedom of speech, which of course is part of the lawsuits that I'm confronting. But the idea of it of science being apolitical and amoral has simply gone out the window. And a lot of the reason is, and of course one of the things again that Maurice Strong did when he set up the IPCC through World Meteorological Organizations was that it meant that all of the funding went through those national weather agencies, and therefore they only funded those people that were trying to prove the theory when proper science should be trying to disprove the theory. So in other words, they completely thwarted the scientific method through the structure, the bureaucratic structure they set up. In Canada, for example, we have two agencies, actually three agencies, that were set up to keep funding for research, government funding for research, at arm's length from the government to keep the politics out of it. So we have the Science Council that funds science research, we have the Social Science and Humanities Council that does that area, and then there's the medical. Climate research funding, all of it went through Environment Canada. And of course, they were simply only funding those people that were going to prove the theory, which was the theory, the IPCC stuff, that they were convincing the politicians was the only true science. That led, of course, into what became the consensus theory, where they say, oh, look, the majority of scientists agree. The majority of publications are on one side of the argument, which proves then that the minority are wrong. Well, science isn't about consensus and numbers, but it is an argument that, of course, had great resonance with the public. And so all of these things were interconnected. And the funding issue, there's been several good articles. Joanne Nova, the Australian woman that's done research on the funding in the U.S., for example, it's something like $70 billion has gone into climate research, which is to prove the theory. But fortunately, there's been enough leaking out to show that the theory doesn't hold up. But the public are not aware of all of those things yet, and hopefully Eric and I can keep informing them.
Well, you know, going back to Melody's question, I'll just give you the basics, Melody. You know, what we teach in physical geography, 21% of the atmosphere gases are oxygen, 78% are nitrogen, which is inert. CO2 is a trace gas. Oh, by the way, about 0.9% is argon. So between those three, oxygen, nitrogen, and argon, you have 99.9% of the atmosphere gases in a state of nature. And, of course, humans have come along, and now we're adding other things. But CO2, which is natural and has been around since the beginning of the Earth, comprises about 380 parts per million, or 0.038%. And that has the IPCC rhetoric is that has increased from about 280 parts per million in the pre-industrial times. However, there's a lot of good science by guys like Jaworski who and Beck who take chemical measurements of CO2 and show that 280 parts per million is actually much lower than it was. In fact, the average for the 19th century might be as high as 340 or some 330 parts per million. And so what we see with the IPCC is actual corruption of data to the extent with ClimateGate. We saw it. That's the Met Office in the CRU in East Anglia. There's NASA Gate now, the Hansen's Goddard Space Institute, GISS, has been caught kind of depressing temperature values in the early 20th century and increasing them in the later 20th century by phasing out certain temperature weather stations, et cetera, in colder areas. And we see the same corruption of data in New Zealand and Australia. And so with AussieGate, ClimateGate, KiwiGate, NASAGate, you know, if the press was fair about this, we would see that, you know, this is not only a failed hypothesis, but this is a vast corruption of science.
Okay.
At the institutional level, because these are governmental. It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's a panel of governments. So the governments of the world seem to be with the UN in wanting to be able to impose these taxes, which would then give vast more money to the UN, which would then allow the UN to be the rudimentary one world government that the New World Order wants, you know, with a one world military and a one world judicial and a one world you know, ability to tax. So Marie Strong said this, that the UN would become kind of the prototype of the nations would lose sovereignty and the UN would gain more power. Well, very interestingly, Joan Vion showed that all the Commonwealth countries, ex-Commonwealth countries like Canada, are obligated. I don't know if this is you agree with this, Tim, but they're obligated to vote with Britain and the UN. So that gives Britain 54 votes out of about 191, which means that Britain runs the world. Well, if you look at this, you know, the BBC is the British Brainwashing Corporation. This is the center of propaganda for the British government. And the BBC World Report and all this stuff, this is central to the propaganda efforts. Oh, the sea level rising is rising faster than we thought. More polar bears are dying than we thought. Computer models show the temperatures rising higher than we thought. Daily, we hear this barrage of lies. And I've traced it pretty much to Britain. And because Britain, I think, is the dominant power behind the UN, Britain wants to be, I think, the controller of the world. I think they think the British Empire is never going to, the sun will never set on the British Empire, but they're going to keep it going by deception. And this is why, said man-made global warming is a hoax that threatens our future and the future of our children. It's a hoax. And the sooner people see where it's coming from so that we can logically counteract it, again, that's why I'm researching the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, a propaganda central, central area, which, of course, expanded all over the world to the Stanford Research Institute and many, many organizations all over the United States with the same mission, which is to propagandize and do mass mind control, really, of the public. And of course, you can control the opinions of people if you can control the information that they get. So the media serves this process in terms of soft mass mind control, just by, people think the more media they watch and listen to, the more they know. That's not true anymore. The more mass media that they imbibe, the less they know about certain critical issues. So that's why people need to turn off their television. They need to read the right books, and they need to get
I've got Dr. Tim Ball and Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And Dr. Ball, you had something you wanted to interject here.
Well, there's a couple of things. One, I would urge people to look at Agenda 21. And that's easy to Google, and of course that was the foundation of so much of what's been going on, and Maurice Strong, of course, behind that. And Maurice Strong also, by the way, he, through the IPCC, he set up and controlled the scientific side of the agenda that they wanted to prove and show that CO2 and humans were the cause. But he then also, being the organizer that he is, set up the Rio conference of 1992, and he was the chairman of that, and that, of course, where they took the whole agenda to the public through the NGOs and the 1992 conference was also where the ideas of what ended up being Kyoto and so on were spawned. And so people need to go and look at that. And if you see what they set out, what their plans were, you start to get an understanding of all these different individual pieces that Eric and I are talking about tonight fit into that general pattern of where things are going. There's one other issue, of course, and Eric's already talked about the control of the data and the manipulation of the data. So much of the data goes through the United Nations, and my experience in giving students assignments to check on the validity of the data from the UN, they don't actually collect the data. They get data from individual nations. Well, of course, those nations produce the data that is suitable to them and politically advantageous to them. And if you go, one of the assignments I used to give my students was, okay, go and tell me what the population of Nigeria is and how it's changed over the last 50 years. Well, you find such a plethora of numbers, it makes no sense at all. And then if you go and look at, for example, levels of illiteracy, well, Cuba lists itself as 100% literacy. Well, that's simply physically impossible. But this is the kind of manipulation and control of the data that goes on. And it's not surprising that the annual numbers of the amount of CO2 that is produced by humans is created from United Nations data, and then with manipulation produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And of course, who stands better to gain from that than showing that the humans are producing more every year? And one of the giveaways was that with the recent last couple of years of downturn in the economy, there should have been a decrease, but it didn't show up. And Eric talked about what Hansen was doing with the data by making the earlier record look colder and the present increasing the slope of the increase of temperature. But the other thing that they're doing is, and I'm glad Eric mentioned Michael Crichton's book, State of Fear, but they're playing on people's fears, the sky is falling, the traditional Chicken Little, but they're also playing on lack of understanding. And that's what hopefully these kinds of programs provide. Right now we're hearing, the storm that went through New York and gave the earliest snowfall on record. And I loved, there was one radio station said it was the earliest snowfall ever, and I phoned them up and said, you really mean ever? The world's 5 billion years old, you know. And of course then you say, well, it's only for official records. Well,
yeah, a little lack of understanding there.
Yeah, exactly. But they're already trying to claim that that's an evidence of global warming. And as I mentioned, that's so incongruous. But what they've done, Melody, is that they've set it up so that every single event that occurs that is natural, they've got people believing it's unnatural. And you see this in the mainstream media. I mean, whether it's CNN or Fox News, they don't just have the weather report anymore. It's all extreme weather.
Right.
And, well, sorry, but a hurricane isn't an extreme event. It's a natural event. Now, it might be, in terms of the damage it can do to you or a region, somewhat extreme, but it's a perfectly natural event. And if you live in a hurricane region, you're going to get hit by it. So what they're doing is every single day there are always natural events occurring, but they're presenting them as if they are unnatural, therefore further proof of their arguments, this is all due to global warming. And it also means, of course, that they never run out of examples because the public simply don't know what the natural patterns are.
Okay, now
One of the classic ones, of course, was, they say there's more hurricanes than there ever were. In fact, there are less hurricanes. As Eric mentioned earlier, the weather's been incredibly stable over the last few decades. But this is all part of the deceptions and corruptions. The other point I wanted to make was something that was talked about with geoengineering that Eric raised the issue about. When I started studying climate back in the 70s, of course, global cooling was the threat. It wasn't picked up as a political issue as warming is today, but it was considered from a political perspective because the CIA wrote at least three reports that I know of, spent several million dollars investigating it, and of course the interest there was in terms of the impact on world food supply, and that was part of the argument about why Ehrlich was saying, by the year 2000 there won't be enough food to feed the world. And of course what the CIA were concerned about was preparing reports for the politicians of where there was going to be social and political unrest. Now, what I want people to think about is at that time also, there were proposals for geoengineering. Fortunately, none of them really were put into place. One of them was a proposal by the Soviets to build a dam across the Bering Straits and block the flow of cold Arctic water into the North Pacific, which would then warm up the world around the middle latitudes. Another one was putting big mirrors up in space to direct more sunlight down to warm the world up. So these ideas were kicking around at that time, but what people need to say to themselves is, if CO2 is a warming gas, a greenhouse gas, what would have happened if they'd have pumped CO2 into the atmosphere then, more of it? Okay? In other words, the point I'm trying to make is, if you don't understand, you don't know what's going on, you're more likely to create more problems than solve the ones that don't exist. And of course, that's the difficulty we're in now. And if you look at it on a global scale, every nation in the world, and we maybe should qualify that because China and India certainly are not playing along, but they're all preparing for a cooler world. A warmer world. But if it cools, as Eric has pointed out, the cold periods are very problematic. You've only got to cool the world down by about 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is about 4 degrees Fahrenheit, And Canada is virtually out of agriculture. But nobody wants to talk about those issues. And yet the evidence is that we are cooling down and we're heading back to at least a mini ice age, much like we had around 1800 to 1820.
Okay, now why would you think they would go in that direction if it's already, you know, the ice age thing has more validity than the global warming one? Why do you think
they'd go there? Isn't that obvious, Melody? They want to.